Okay, so we're looking in the book of Romans. I want to give you a little bit of a repaint the picture that we started off with. We started off in the book of Romans looking, you know, the first section, the second section, and I know that sometime in the beginning I went through what the Roman church was really about, what they looked like, and I wanted to repaint that picture a little bit. The Roman church was an interesting church in that it was filled with both Jews and Gentiles. The Jewish people were probably the beginnings of the church. But then there was a time in Rome when all the Jews in Rome, Christian or not, were kicked out of Rome. And so these Jews in the Christian church were forced to leave Rome for a period of time because of persecution. And during that time, we presume that the Gentile, non-Jew contingent of the church sort of took over and became the leadership in the church. And then shortly thereafter, the Jews were allowed back into Rome. And so then you've got the Jewish founders of the church, the original leaders coming back. And so you've got this interesting mix. You can imagine the social dynamic that takes place when you've got this kind of shuffling going on and leadership shifts that were involved in the Roman church. And then overlaid kind of on top of that is this question of why is it, in fact, that some of the Jews are coming to Jesus Christ and some have not? Why are some becoming, you know, Christians and some are not? And so that question was in the air, sort of in the atmosphere floating around. And into all of this confusion comes Paul. And he hasn't been to Rome, but he's writing them a letter and he's saying, I'm coming to visit you. And he's Jewish, and yet he's coming to visit them. And he says he's going to bounce off from where they are and go further afield to Spain, where there are fewer Jews, farther away from Jerusalem, and he's going to minister to the people there. And Paul, why are you doing this? You're a Jew. You should be going to the Jews, right? But here you're going to come and use this as a launching pad to go further away and minister to more Gentiles. And so you've got these sort of atmospherics where there's lots of questions surrounding the Jews and the Gentiles, and there's a social issue that I'm sure was very much in the forefront of their minds. And Paul has been talking about the gospel, and here in chapter 10, 9, 10, and 11, he's really addressing this question of the Jews, of Israel. How does Israel fit into this process of the advancement of the gospel? And what really cuts through the Jewish-Gentile issue question here is, in fact, the gospel. This idea of the good news of God's grace made available in Jesus Christ. When you think of this thorny issue and the social implications there, what's going to cut through it is the gospel. And that's what Paul's going to emphasize. He drives home the point that the gospel is the solution to our understanding of what seems like a confusing situation. And in this process, he does two things. He answers an important question for us, which is the Jewish-Gentile question. And as a matter of fact, we still wrestle with that today, right? We're still dealing with that issue today. Very much in the history of humans, that issue has continued to be at the center of some of the primary issues. And so it's important to us on that level. But it's important to us on another level. Because what Paul does here is he takes a difficult social issue and he solves it. And the way he solves it is by focusing on the good news of the gospel. And this is a lesson for us because we have lots of thorny, challenging, difficult social issues too to grapple with. And the way we're going to solve them, my contention is, from reading this text, is through the gospel. The gospel holds in it the message of God's grace made available in Jesus Christ, holds in it the solution to all of these social ills and problems, whether it's how we deal with the rise of Islam or how we deal with the environment. We talked about that recently. How we deal with controversial subjects like homosexuality, all of this, anything you can bring up. The contention is that at bottom, what cuts through it all and brings understanding and solution and hope is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's what Paul teaches us in this text, along with helping us to understand the very particular issue of the relationship between the Jews and the Gentiles. So what we're going to focus on this morning is learning to keep the focus on the gospel. That's what Paul's really doing with us here this morning. So look with me in Romans chapter 9, verse 30. I'm going to skip the couple of the first two verses because they really repeat what goes on in the rest of the text. So we're going to start in chapter 10, verse 1 is where we're going to be starting. Again, this is page 786, Romans chapter 10, verse 1. Paul says to these Roman churchgoers, "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved." Now, you could just sort of imagine the atmospherics here. Paul's coming, he's ministering to the Gentiles, and I'm wondering if some of the Jews in the church are wondering, you know, what's up with this guy, and how come he goes to the Gentiles, and does he not like his own kind? And he is about disabusing them of that thought. He's saying, no, look, I have deep concern. In fact, in the previous chapter, he said that he'd be willing to be condemned himself for the sake of the Jews. He has great love for them. So there's something else going on here that drives him to move on to the Gentiles. Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. For I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Now, again, put yourself in that church and you can imagine, you can see how the zeal of the Jews would be kind of a stumbling block for those who are in the church. I mean, they'd be sitting there looking at how zealous these Jews are, and they'd be saying, you know, these people are so serious about their religious practice, and yet you're saying that they've missed the mark. And yet we're all saying that they've missed the mark. They're so zealous about it, and yet they've missed. How can that be? And the same thing happens with us today, right? That we know people who are very zealous about their spirituality, whatever form it might be taking. And I know I've had lots of conversations with people and say, well, that person is just so focused on their spirituality that, you know, they must have it. They must be getting it right. And what Paul's saying is it's not about sincerity. It's not just about sincerity. There's a missing piece. If you're just sincere, but you're sincere in the wrong direction, then there's a missing piece. And that's what Paul's saying about the Jews and applies to our circumstance as well. Verse 4. Christ, he says, on the other hand, is the end of the law. That is to say, Christ is the end of the law as a means to righteousness, as a means of getting into right relationship with God. Christ is the end of the law as a means to getting in right relationship with God. So that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. And then he goes on to explain what he means here. Moses describes in this way the righteousness that is by the law. The man who does these things will live by them. But the righteousness that is by faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the deep, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. In other words, favor with God is not about perfect obedience to the law, as he describes. And it's not about, you know, climbing on your hands and knees up to heaven, right, in your own strength and in your own power, nor is it about digging deep into a hole to some secret place where Jesus is. Like I get the image of a person in jail trying to dig themselves away out of jail to freedom, right? It's not about those, he says. It's not about either one of those. It's this, verse 8. But what does it say? The word is near you. It's not far and impossible. It's not a mirage. It's not an impossible dream. The word is near you, he says. It is in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith we are proclaiming. And here it is. Here's how you approach God and come into favor with God. Restore that relationship. It's not climbing to the highest heaven on your own strength or digging to the deepest hole. It's this, verse 9, that if you confess with your mouth, that's the outward expression, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart, that's the inward component. Remember, I was working with a Jewish student one time, and he said, I can confess with my mouth, but it's the heart part that I'm struggling with, right? Because it's got to be sincere confession. If you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For it is with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it is with your mouth that you confess and are saved. As the scripture says, anyone who trusts in him will never be put to shame. In other words, it's not complex. It's not far off. This is not like the tax code, and you have to follow it in order to be in right relationship with God. That's not how it works. It's more like a news article. Somebody has given a piece of news, and the required response is simply to believe it, to believe that it's true. That's how it works. It's not a tax code that you have to follow. It's a news article that you receive and you believe. And in that respect, Paul is saying, look, it's near you. It doesn't require all that zeal in the sense that the Jews were seeking to live out the law and do it perfectly because that was impossible. it's much nearer to you because Jesus has come close to you rather than you having to go to Him. That's what Paul says. It's near to you. We're going to come back to that. Verse 12, "For there is no difference between Jew and Gentile. The same Lord is Lord of all and richly blesses all who call on Him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." There's the solution to the Jewish-Gentile problem. The playing field has been leveled. It's about openness to the good news of Jesus Christ. It's about openness to the gospel. That's how you solve the problem. The only question that matters is, has the news been received? Has the good news, the gospel, that God's favor is available in Jesus Christ, has that been received? Now, because it's a question of news, there's a very important piece that goes along with this. News needs to be related, right? It needs to be passed on. It needs to be proclaimed. It needs to be spoken and shared. That's what Paul's going to talk about now. How, verse 14, then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. In other words, the gospel is simply a message to be believed, but it needs to be heralded. It needs to be proclaimed. It needs to be out there so that people can hear it, and then they can follow on with belief. Now, in Paul's time and Jesus' time, there was this office, this person called the herald. And the herald was the officer of the king. And he would go out whenever he had news, and he would stand in the middle of the village or the town or the place in the square, and he would proclaim the news. And people would get their news that way. Obviously, they didn't have television and radio and internet and all the things that we have. And so in place of all that, there was a guy with a big voice who would go in the middle of the town and proclaim what needed to be proclaimed, proclaim the news. And Paul is saying that that's what the gospel needs. It's a piece of news, and it needs somebody to proclaim it. And God has already set up a system for that. I love what John Stott does. He sort of turns around this process that Paul talks about here so that it reads kind of like this. First, Christ sends heralds, okay, proclaimers. Heralds proclaim. People hear. Hearers believe. Believers call. Those who call are saved. See, that's the process that God has ordained for this message to go out into the world, this message of God's favor being made available in Jesus Christ. So then the question comes, verse 16, but not all the Israelites accepted the good news, right? There's still a problem because the proclaimers have gone out, and yet some people haven't received it. How do you explain that, Paul? Well, for Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our message, consequently faith comes from hearing the message, and the message is heard through the word of Christ. That's what we were just saying. But I ask, did they not hear? In other words, is that the problem? You know, they weren't there when the proclaimer went out. They didn't hear the message. They didn't get the news. Is that the problem? Is that why they haven't come? And Paul answers it like this. He says, quoting from Psalm 19, which we read actually just a few weeks back, their voice has gone out into all the earth. Anybody know what their voice refers to? Any ideas who that voice refers to? Psalm 19, we talked about it in the park. What's that? No. The stars. The heavens declare, right, the glory of God. Their voice, the word of the gospel has gone out and it's been made available because of God's creation. Their voice has gone out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. So in other words, is it that they didn't hear? No, it can't be because their voice has gone out into all creation. They heard. Verse 19, again I ask, okay, here's another possible problem. Did Israel not understand? Is it that they didn't understand? First, Moses says, I will make you envious by those who are not a nation. I will make you angry by a nation that has no understanding. And here's what he's getting at there. Look, the Gentiles who have no understanding have understood because God has made it plain to them. How much more then has he already made it plain to the Jews? So it's not a question of understanding and not understanding. God has gone bent overboard to make it understandable to all. Look what the next verse says. Isaiah 20 boldly says, Verse 20, Isaiah boldly says, I was found by those who did not seek me. And this, I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. So, yes, they have understood, because that's been God's process all along. It's not a question of understanding. Here's the answer. Here's the solution. Here's why the Israelites in this case, those who've not come to Christ, and anybody really, extending on from that, says this, all day long, I have held out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. In other words, he's saying God has come after them over and over again. And if you know, you read the story of the Old Testament over and over again. It's about this God who comes out of heaven and he just seeks his people and he tries to draw them back and he proclaims to them and the message of the gospel. And then we go into the New Testament and now it's not just sending prophets, it's sending his own son, and he's proclaiming this message over and over and over and over again, and he's beckoning to them with compassion and calling them to come back. And the only excuse, the only reason they haven't come is because of their own disobedience and their own obstinacy. That's what Paul's saying. Essentially, the responsibility is theirs. God has made every effort, but the people have been disobedient and obstinate. And the reason that some of the Jews have missed the gospel, and the reason why Paul is going to go further afield than Israel and go out into Spain, where he wants to go, and all these places, is because of their failure to be open to the news. And he's going to go to where there's openness. So you see, in the gospel, we have the solution to the problem. We have a lot of things going on in this text. And in the time that we have, I have a couple of things I want to draw out and for us to focus on. A couple of things about the gospel and about proclaiming the gospel. The first one is this. This text reminds us again that it's simple, really. The gospel is simple. The message of the gospel is near you. It's not far away. You don't have to climb on your hands and knees to the sky. You don't have to dig through to some secret chamber in the earth. The message of the gospel is near to you and to everybody around you. That's what this text says. It's not impossible. It's not far away. Martin Lloyd-Jones had a way of talking about this, and I get this through Tim Keller. Martin Lloyd-Jones would ask this question. He would say, what's the difference between a herald and an advisor? Right? A herald and an advisor tells you what to do in the future, right? Like, here's how you should live going ahead. A herald proclaims something that's already happened, a piece of news. And he extends this out. He says, imagine if you were living in Jesus' day or somewhere around that time when the herald was really living, and let's say your people are at war with another people and you're in your village wondering what's happening. He said, imagine that the battle goes well, okay? The battle goes well, the king will send the herald back to the village. And he'll stand in the middle and he'll say, we won the battle. You're free. Fear not. Right? If the battle doesn't go so well, what does the king do? He sends his advisors to the village. And he says, get ready. Because the battle is coming to you. You know, forge the earthen works, dig in. Here's what you should do. Here's how we're going to prepare. Because the battle is coming. And you're not free yet. The gospel falls on the herald side, Martin Lloyd-Jones says. The battle has been won, and the herald comes to town and says, look, you're free. You could just go about your life. The battle's done. You don't have to worry about these marauders coming in. On the other side, most religions, maybe all religions, fall on the advisory side. They say, here's what you should do. And they bring a set of laws and rules and guidelines and techniques and methods for living. In fact, many want to turn Christianity into this kind of a religion. A set of methods and techniques to create out of Christianity a religion of advisors. In fact, because this is the way religions usually work, they're about advising people what to do, most people who are unfamiliar with the Christian faith assume that that's what following Jesus is about. It's about getting a new advisor, right? And if we're silent about grace, then we just allow that presumption to perpetuate. And people misunderstand what it means to follow Christ. Part of our struggle is this, is that there is, in fact, a transformational side. After hearing the good news, we are changed. We are transformed. We seek change, but it's more out of gratitude from hearing the news than it is from this trying to get close to God. And the problem, though, is this, is that if people see us seeking and trying to change, but they don't hear about the gospel, they don't hear the news, then it's very easy for them to get the wrong impression. It has to be obvious that, is in Keller's words, we're not just hammering on our wills and trying to become better people. Right? It has to be obvious we're not just advising one another about how to become better people. That we're actually responding to good news that's been proclaimed. And we're living in the shadow of that good news. That's the gospel. It's a simple message, and it's near to us, and it's near to the people around you. It's not so complex. And that flows right into the second point I have this morning, which Paul calls us to, and that is to proclaim it. The gospel needs to be proclaimed. Your job and my job is not to advise people, first of all, on new techniques for living. That's not what it is. It's on proclaiming the news that the battle's been won already. The battle against sin and decay and fallenness and brokenness. It's been won already. That's a piece of news. And our job, first and foremost, is to proclaim that news. There's an interesting parallel here with the science of heraldry. The herald. As you move on in time from the time of Jesus' day, and you go into the Middle Ages, you get coats of arms, right? All families had these coats of arms and these shields that had special designs and unique emblems on them. And with that developed what's called the science of heraldry. And the herald in that day was somebody who was able to read all of the signs on the shields. And every symbol, every color, every little line, every pattern, every aspect of the coat of arms communicated something. And for the uninitiated, it was just a bunch of gobbledygook. They couldn't read it, right? You had to be trained, and they had volumes training people how to read the shields and determine what it was that it was saying and who it belonged to and what it was saying about them. Well, the same thing can happen with our proclamation of the gospel, right? We can turn it into a complex science where only the initiated can understand. And we lose sight of the fact that it is a simple message that is near to every one of us. People who haven't understood the minutiae of the various aspects, suddenly the gospel becomes opaque to them and far away. And we turn ourselves into a body of advisors. And that's not what we've been called to be, Paul says. We're simply heralds in the simplest sense, proclaimers of this news. Take, for example, a difficult issue like homosexuality. This comes up all the time these days. Now, here's the advisor type approach to homosexuality. And I know this is a generalization. I know you're finding yourselves in very unique circumstances, and you can't make a blanket sort of statement on this is how you approach it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Take this divisive social issue. How does the gospel cut through it and sort of bring some clarity to where there's so much confusion? Okay, the herald would go like this, right? Because you get into, the advisor would go like this. You get into a conversation with somebody about homosexuality, and the advisor says, okay, look, here's what you should do, okay, about this struggle you're having, or the people that you know who are homosexual or whatever. Here's what the Bible says, and here's what you should do. And quickly, you get into this discussion about the various scriptures and how to interpret them in the Greek and the Hebrew and what they mean, and you go back and forth in dialogue and debate. Now, there is a place for that. And I can be as nerdy as the nerdiest and get into that debate and that, you know, talking about these things. But it's not the first place for us to go. We've done something really wrong if we haven't gone first to the gospel. And here's the gospel. Here's the herald approach to that. Would be to say something more like this. Look, as people, true, we tend to be pretty messed up in terms of our sexuality. And not only in terms of homosexuality, but adultery in marriage, use of pornography, and you can say, I don't care if you're talking about inside the church or outside the church, as people, we tend to be pretty messed up in this area. But the good news is that Jesus Christ came, and He overcame our sin by dying on the cross. And He offers us grace and forgiveness. See, that's what the herald does. The herald turns that opportunity, that situation, to opportunity to proclaim the good news. Not to stand as advisor over somebody else, but to say, hey, look, just like you, I need this news that I found, which is really good. That when we've messed up in the world, God dropped down out of heaven because of His great love. And He came to this world and He devised a plan to overcome our sin. And the amazing thing is that it worked. And the news is that it's near to you. You can have it. There's another important aspect of this proclamation. There's the herald approach, but the herald approach can be broken down in a couple of ways. Jesus proclaimed the gospel, the Bible says, by word and by deed. In fact, if you go to the book of Matthew, and you might do this sometime, maybe this afternoon, the book of Matthew is divided up into word and deed. It's really interesting. It's a very clear division. It tells us what Jesus said, and it'll have long quotations of Jesus, and then it'll go to what Jesus did, and a long story about what He did, and then go back to what He said, and it just toggles back and forth. And I think that we need to pull a page out of the book of Matthew as we seek to proclaim the good news that we've been given, that's been entrusted to us. And really what it is our struggle is to get the balance right between word and deed. Some of us proclaim really well verbally, right? We're good at speaking the gospel. But nobody cares when we say it, because we act like jerks most of the time. And they really don't care what we have to say, because we don't have any mercy in us, we don't have any grace in us, we don't have any compassion, and we don't have any love, and it's obvious. And we've never sacrificed for anybody around us. So we're good at saying it, but people aren't listening. And then other of us fall on the other side. We have this wonderful servant-type heart, and we're sacrificing for people all the time, and we're showing them mercy and grace and forgiveness and love, and we never get around to describing what is motivating us deep down and why we're living the way that we're living. And here's the sad, really sad part about that form of proclamation. What it looks like from the outside is that you're just really good at hammering on your will and making yourself into a good person. It looks like you're really religious and you're zealous, you know, to do the right thing. Because you got to have both word and deed. Without, you leave an unclear picture of who Jesus is. And so people don't know who they're interacting with. You haven't brought them to the person of Jesus Christ. And so my challenge for us is to focus both on word and deed. Our recent heritage in terms of church history is on the verbal side. We come out of a history, a tradition, which in the last 50 years, before that was very much, very strong on the deed side, but in the last 50, 75, maybe 100 years, has been almost entirely on the verbal side, the preaching the gospel verbally. and not so good on the living it out with our deeds. And it's exciting to me. In our home groups, we're having lots of conversations about this, and we're making some strides, and it's exciting to me to see what's happening on this. Are becoming more focused on proclaiming the gospel through our deeds along with our words. And I don't know where this will take us. And I'm guessing that some of you are going to be called to some pretty interesting ministry opportunities as a result of it. And I'm excited to see what that's going to be. But Tim Keller says one thing that is very important. He says, here's how you know when you're getting the balance right between proclaiming the gospel with your words and proclaiming it with your deeds. He says that what Jesus said you'll experience will be true. There's two things he said, and they'll simultaneously be true at the same time. Jesus said that the people will see your good works and they will praise your Father in heaven. Right? He said that. And so if you're proclaiming the gospel through your deeds, that will be happening. People will see your good works and they will praise your Father in heaven. And we've seen that already. We've seen with our Count Me In. Atheist friends who say with real sincerity, it is just so wonderful what you guys are doing. It makes such a difference in these people's lives and opens up conversation. But Jesus said this other thing, and this will be true, and he said it a little ways after in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are those who are persecuted, right? And so if we're getting this right, if we're proclaiming with word and with deed, simultaneously, we are going to be experiencing both people praising because of the good works and people persecuting because of the things that they disagree with. And this is the key way that we're going to know that we're getting this balance right. That both, one and the same time, we're going to be having persecution and praise both at the same time. So, we need to proclaim the gospel. It's simple. We need to work at figuring out how it is on a human level to bring people into context with God's mercy and grace. Perhaps first you have to bring them into context with human mercy and human grace so that you can start to talk about divine mercy and divine grace. And we need to make sure that we don't make it more complex than it is, because the gospel is near. It's the gospel that just needs to be told and believed. Lord, would you help us in this process? For those of us who are sitting here this morning and we are word-oriented people, convict us of the imbalance in our lives. Perhaps we've not been willing to sacrifice for our coworker or our family member or the neighbor near us. And it's a sin. And we confess it this morning. Because we've been talking about the gospel a lot, but we haven't been embodying it. Jesus went to the cross and sacrificed tremendously. And the call upon us is to embody that willingness to sacrifice for others. Some of us just keep talking. We talk about the minutiae, the theology, the Hebrew, the Greek, and our lives are not a picture of grace and mercy. And we come off like some advisor, just like any religion. Some of us are on the other side and we have servants' hearts and we've been serving and sacrificing and forgiving people, showing them human mercy so that they could come into contact with divine mercy. But we failed to proclaim the good news verbally. To say to the people around us, you know, I'm really a jerk when it comes down to it, and God's just drenching me in His gospel, and somehow my life is being changed, and I find I'm able to sacrifice for others and serve, and I'm loving what God's doing to me, but I'm no different. I'm just a broken person who's received a bit of good news. Lord, we confess as a community, it's hard for us sometimes to proclaim your good news, living in a place where oftentimes your voice has been shunned and rejected. But at the same time, we declare this morning that nothing is impossible for you. And we lay ourselves before you to use our words and to use our deeds for this awesome task of getting the news out. The glorious, tremendous, precious, amazing, surprising news that in Jesus Christ there is forgiveness and freedom and favor with God. Lord, empower us as a community and in our home groups and as individuals in the places where you have us. In Jesus' name, amen.